Welcome to Talking About Forests, a podcast series hosted jointly by Dalberg Advisors and Wildlife Conservation Trust. Join hosts Dr. Anish Andheria, President of the Wildlife Conservation Trust, and Neerad Bhatnagar, partner at Dalberg, as they engage in stimulating conversations with researchers, conservationists, bureaucrats, and philanthropists on extremely pressing topics, including governance, forest management, ecosystem services, wildlife crime, and human-wildlife conflict.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to this episode of Talking About Forests with the environmental historian, Dr. Mahesh Rangarajan. He is much more than a historian to a lot of conservationists. I've had the privilege to be his student, and I have never seen somebody as eloquent as him. I have also had the pleasure to feel very awkward when we were both reading Joining the Dots, and that's the time when I was doing my master's, and we were both photocopying, rather downloading the first draft. I finished 20 pages, and he had ran through the entire report, and he didn't even miss one comma full stop. So he reads one paragraph at a time, and that is why he's a storehouse of so much information that 10 hours will not be enough. And I'm very, very happy to have him here. Mahesh, thank you so much.
My privilege. Since you're my former student, people should deduct 95% of the facts from what you say. But I appreciate the spirit.
So, Neerad, over to you.
Great. So, I'll do the formal sort of introduction. Dr. Mahesh Rangarajan is a reputed researcher, author, and historian with a special interest in environmental history and colonial history. He has a DPhil from Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. Presently, he's the Vice Chancellor and Professor of History and Environmental Studies at Kriya University, and formerly the Head of the Department and Professor at Ashoka University. Recently, he has been made the honorary foreign member at the American Historical Association for his exhaustive work in this academic field. He has written extensively on environmental history. His first book, Fencing the Forest, was published in 1996, and the most recent, Nature and Nation, in 2018. His co-edited works include India's Environmental History and At Nature's Edge. Extremely honored to have him with us here today to share his perspectives on forests through the lens of history. Welcome, Mahesh. Really looking forward to this.
Thank you. My privilege.
So let's get started. Mahesh, tell us, how did your tryst with forest and conservation come about? What were your motivations and inspirations?
Well, I mean, the interest was in animals. Growing up in a very small town, not far from where I am, Kriya University is in Chittoor, and I lived for some years with my grandparents. The only place you got to see animals was the circus. And we learned names like Royal Bengal Tiger and African Lion, looking at rather tiny little cages and animals prancing. I moved to Delhi, and one of the first sights I'll never forget as a 4.5 or 5 year old is that we were in the car. We're about to enter Delhi Zoo, a Jeep came up, and at the back of the Jeep, open Jeep, was a man in a safari jacket with an enormous tiger. So I was very lucky that I grew up at a time when Delhi was a city with lots of trees and birds, and part of the joys of birding done with non-existent binoculars and a very battered copy of Salim Ali is that we got active in doing a lot of birding on weekends in the ridge. And 78, 79, some of us got involved in trying to protect the ridge. And I think at that time, the interest in birds, animals, plants, trees also blended into some early sort of peaceful but very consistent protest. And we were lucky in 1980, that area was declared protected. And during that particular set of events, we brought out a small newsletter, and this newsletter was to be released. And we descended on a function where the great Dr. Salim Ali was speaking. By then, he was rather old. So even with his hearing aid, he sometimes couldn't hear what was being asked. So the chair, Mr. Rajat Daksha, would read out the question. So the question we put was that if a forest is being cut down, what will happen to the birds? And we went and explained that the rich area is being cut and we are organizing a protest. We got a lot of support from the audience, but more importantly, someone who was to be a pivotal influence in our lives was in the audience. He met us immediately and he hugged each one of us. He blessed us and he said, it's very good you're working in Delhi, but do you know what's happening in Garhwal and Kumaon? And please come as my guest. Come on Padyatra. And as you must have guessed, this was Sundarlal Bhavnagar. So I think that I was very lucky that, you know, totally different type of figure, Skylab Sankla, Sundarlal Bahuguna. And I must say, you know, you were saying something about being a teacher. And after the first or second visit to Mr. Sankla's house, he asked a lot of questions. What is Bara Singha? What is that photo? And then he said, these books, you can take any book you want, but you have to give it back in 1 week and you have to tell me what is it. So one of the first books two of us borrowed was by Randall Eaton on the Cheetah. At that time, it was a big classic. I couldn't understand head or tail of much of the book, but the patience, enormous time he gave. And again, from a very different end of the movement, Sundarlalji. So for us, the environment, we entered it as a movement, started studying history, and at some time, Dunu Roy, the Shahdol group, we did a lot of work with him, about 30 of us over the summer vacations in the 80s. And he was a remarkable person from a batch of IIT 67, who spent a lot of his time looking at technology and the environment, not only with a focus on pollution, but in terms of what is today called sustainability, particularly for the underclasses, workers, people who graze cattle, people who catch fish. And he was particular that whatever passion we have, we should integrate it into our studies. And whatever discipline we learn, we should combine our passion for what we are interested in with that discipline. So I think these were the kinds of people who set the sort of big benchmarks. And these are people who inspire you, whether you live the dream or not, you keep trying.
Thank you so much. Over to you, Nirad.
Thank you, Mahesh. Thanks for sharing that. You've got a very interesting background which sort of merges environmental history, colonial history. So how do you think that has shaped the way you think about conservation, about forests? And especially, let's say, if you were to juxtapose that with somebody who, let's say, might have had a background in economics or technology or biology, what's the lens that your background has shaped for you?
So one of the consequences, if you ask a historian a question, we're liable to tell you that the correct answer or the good answer is wrong. If you ask them for a solution, we're liable to tell you it's a little complicated. And there's a reason. I think history as a discipline tries to create a sense of context. You don't just ask, where are we? You ask, how did we get here? Are there certain turns in the road where there were certain very critical choices made or decisions which had consequences? Now, it's easy when you think of consequences which flow directly from a decision. So we know in the 1860s, there was a timber famine in many parts of India. Contractors were roaming around forests, chopping down trees left, right, and center. And the railways, instead of getting a steady supply of logs, the time the railways were going to massively expand, that weren't getting it. But what is interesting is the solution that they found was to have a huge debate, which goes on for 13 years. They enact a forest act, which effectively helps take over within 30 years. Something like almost 600,000 square kilometers of land. So the origin of the forest department, the immediate origins, they in a timber farm. Their other interest was that there'd been a lot of work in the previous 30 to 40 years, from the 1840s to the 70s, on the relationships between forests, rainfall, and something the scientists of that day called desiccation, the progressive drying of the land. So there was also the belief that the British forester was saving agriculture and Indians from certain disaster. And there's a relationship between the forest as timber and water for agriculture. But remember, even in 1860, 60% of the land of the revenue was land revenue. So I think a historian, when looking at the forest dilemma, will also look at the origins. In this case, the origins of the forest department. Now, of course, origins don't determine character, but sometimes they can play a larger role than we think. So historians try to look at where we are, why, when, and how. But we look not only at intended, we also look at unintended consequences. So one of the contrasts of areas where large areas of forest were reserved, India, and other places where they were not, is that the takeover of forests may have played a role in stopping the advance of agricultural cultivation, which historically has been a very major driver of the denudation of forests. This may be an unintended, it's very important. So I think history is about the study of why, when, and how we got to where.
Yeah. So when you engage on current issues, when you work, when you do your work, how would you, let's say, approach a problem differently from, let's say, an environmental economist, right? And if you can just give an example of maybe something that you did in the last 5-7 years where the historical view was very important.
So I'll go back a little more. 2010, I headed the Elephant Task Force, and I'm probably the first and last historian ever to head a task force on elephants. And the people on it knew much more elephants. There was no economist. But I think an economist would have done what we did, which is to put together how many people are affected by crop damage due to elephants. The figure is quite large. It's 500,000 families. So you can do the math. and I'm not getting into the figures. There's one figure which is very important, tragic. 400 people a year in 2010 were killed by elephants, and over 100 elephants were killed by people. Most of the elephants killed by people were not tuskers. They were killed in defense of crops by laborers, farmers, cultivators. Now, an economist would be very good at telling you the profit loss and putting a price. Now, of course, I'm not saying they put a price on human life, but they put a price on crops. They look at it in the incentive structure. But as a student of history, I would go a step further. I'm not saying economists won't, but the way one poses the question, why, is different. And as you can imagine, there are two very sharp polarized views which are reigned between them. One which says it's human society at fault. The expansion of the human space, not just numbers, living space, the quantum of the gross nature product taken by humans has expanded so much that a large creature like the elephant, one of the largest creatures to live, the largest on the Asian mainland and the second largest on any mainland, needs living space. And humans, too many, humans doing too much, elephants being crowded out. That's one. The reverse, human interests cannot be subordinated to animals. And after all, these are people working for a livelihood. This is not a sports stadium or a golf course. It's not a bingo hall or a casino. I think as a student of history, it helped to be in that debate. And of course, I'll credit to my colleagues. It's a collective view. We argued both are victims. The elephants killed in such situation and the humans are both victims. They're victims of victims. They are being caught up in a process which is rooted in the past. Now, we can't go back and change the past. So one of the things you learn in history is you can't do the experiment again. What we can do is look forward. So when we look forward, can we have ways of separating people and elephants? Ideally. But will there be less than ideal situations? Absolutely. 60% of elephant habitat in India is outside protected area and forests. There may be some areas where you can secure corridors. However many you secure, there'll still be a lot of other areas. What do you do there? And I think what helps with a sense of history is that we tried to distill the problem down. And we got 10 areas where 80% of the deaths were, of both, by the way, elephants and people. Each is specific, each is different. Now, what we suggested is not an answer, but as a historian, I think history is about contingency. You know, it's not about models, it's about humans. And one of the interesting things about humans is you can't predict how we'll behave. And I'm now told, and a very, very nice discovery around that time, animal studies was coming up. I was told many of the ideas we assumed are uniquely human also apply to many animals. So there's a lot of work now. One of Dr. Andheria's juniors in the course, a couple of batches later, Nishad Srinivasaya has finished a very nice doctorate from NIS. He shows elephants, different elephants also have different personalities. So we suggested putting someone who understands the animal behavior, someone who knows the agronomy, and someone who's a vet scientist in each of the 10 locations and working out site-specific answers. So I think history teaches you to look for patterns and it allows for diversity of experience and outcome. It tries to measure up the richness of the human lived experience. And our dilemma is that historically, we've not tried to do that vis-a-vis the ecological context. So I think historians can give us senses of when things worked in the past. And I think that is important. It gives us insights. It also shows us each of these is a specific case. The third, fourth time may not be the same.
Thank you, Mahesh. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And the next question is, you know, something that people working in the field of conservation, especially people working in the forestry sector, they have seen a massive shift just in the last 40, 50 years. Their formula of protection was very different. It was based on exclusion, where they talked of protecting areas minus human beings. And over the last 40, 50 years, through a lot of tug of wars, a lot of debates, now we have moved into an era where we talk of inclusive conservation, where protected area network is not the only way to protect. Since I started in early 80s and till about 15 years ago, I would say, you know, you cannot have tigers and elephants with people in there. You need to isolate animals from people. And now we talk of coexistence all the time. So this kind of shift that you see, I am very proud Indian and I feel that the way India does its conservation, there's a lot to learn from, and not only in the developing nations, but also the developed nations. So, you know, those important pit stops that happened in this last 50 years, why the conservation ethos in India has evolved into what it is today.
Let me go back to the beginning. So I think in the late 60s, to early 70s was a time of intense political economic crisis globally. And part of that crisis was people raising new demands of equality of nations, equality of subjugated peoples. What is of interest to us is the idea of equality across species, equality across generations. So 1972 is a very interesting year. India launches Operation Tiger. Around same time, Kenya launches enormous effort to protect Lake Nakuru, which had 500,000 flamingos. Bangladesh, newly independent country, declares the Royal Bengal Tiger its national animal. And Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, you know, it's a country which has been through cyclone, a great genocide, takes steps to create the Sundarbans Tiger Reserve. In China, which has gone through enormous period, particularly during Great Leap Forward of the destruction of sparrows, during Cultural Revolution of hunting down of tigers, they present two pandas to Richard Nixon. Most unlikely figure, Republican president, who came down hard against the anti-Vietnam War protesters, signs the Endangered Species Act 1972, which among other things declares the timber wolf for protected species. And it may interest you, it's only between 68 and 72 that US moved to ban the DDT and recovery of peregrine falcon and bald eagle began under Republican president. So part of the reason is state structures do absorb ideas even from adversaries, even from unlikely rivals. Now, Mrs. Indira Gandhi is cut from a very different cloth from Mao Zedong and Richard Nixon. She was not leader of an imperial power, which is what United States was, though it's not an imperialist power in the old sense. Americans don't create colonies. They have retreated from Iraq, Afghanistan. But we should have no doubt it's a very major dominant military economic power. China is a communist one-party state. Mrs. Indira Gandhi was a product of the Indian freedom struggle. And we know that in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, there's a deep engagement of people in that struggle with ideas which we would today call environment. So in the 30s, she writes to her father a remarkable letter. And you're going to laugh when I say this. She says there's a new substance called nylon. It can be used for everything from lingerie to socks. And the harder you pull, the tighter it, the stronger it gets. And she quotes an author who said, chemistry is giving us substances which are superior to those that nature gives us. Few weeks later, she writes another much more interesting letter for me, written by a European on the life of ants and birds and bees. And she writes that the nature is very important and nature has its own rhythms and we need to understand it. And science should be allied to life. So I think somewhere, you know, in the 50s, we also go back and see her as the president of Delhi Birdwatcher Society, 2 years before she became president of All India Congress Committee. A new book by Jairam Ramesh, she has found sources none of us had seen. It's a very interesting source. It's displayed in the Indira Gandhi Museum. 1959, she writes a letter. And you know, any 13-year-old boy would cavil at such a letter from his mother in any culture. It starts by the words, "My dear darling, Rajiv, we have been given tiger skin by Maharaja Riva. And I feel sad every time I see the skin. This tiger must have been roaring in the jungle, frightening other animals. And here he is, deprived of his life. I so wish he could be free in his jungle." So I think there's a leader who's left fear is turned to fear. And we tend to forget this India of late 60s had been through two droughts. First time in independent India, there were 2 years of drought. India had to get 19 million tons of grain, the launch of grain revolution. But one dimension of that is that the link between forests, water security, rainfall, you know, aridity was seen as important. So the 72 Act on wildlife, the 1980 Forest Conservation Act were not only about wildlife, they were about forest. And we should keep in mind, this is a time the forest department tended to see forests as a source of revenue. The gentleman you named Kailash Sankhala, even the others, the great Sanjoy Debroy, H.S. Pawar, Saroj Raj Chowdhury, their entire life had been in the wildlife field. They were the exceptional type of foresters. Most foresters in the territorial, they looked at a forest and said, how much revenue can I generate? These chap looked at a forest and said, where will the chital go to drink water? How can I make it safer for the hornbill? So I think there was this new aesthetic consciousness. And it's also interesting, since one of the listeners, the former student, knows the Hindi cinema, there was very interesting film, you know, at this time, Zanjeer, first hit film of Amitabh Bachchan. You may not recall this dialogue. It is by a figure known as Sher Khan. Look at the inversion. The bad, evil Sher Khan who tries to eat Mowgli, here is a hero. He's a Pathan. He's brave. He avoids a fight, but when there is a fight for honor and dignity, he goes in. And he tells somebody who gives to give money to kill a brave police officer that हम शेर है गीदड़ नहीं आई एम द टाइगर नॉट जकॉल हम पैसे के लिए काम नहीं करेगा एंड ही सेज शेर को मारने पर सरकार ने कानून बनाया है शेर बहुत कम हो गया हमारा नंबर ऑफ टाइगर्स इज डिक्लाइंड वी आर ट्राइंग टू प्रोटेक्ट टाइगर सो यू नो इवन मिस्टर सलीम एंड जावेद दे न्यू दैट दिस टाइगर कंजर्वेशन हैज कम सो आई थिंक देयर इज अ न्यू कॉन्शियसनेस ऑफ इन इंडिया एंड दैट दिस इंडिया शुड प्रोटेक्ट इट्स हेरिटेज इट्स नॉट अ कोइंसिडेंस प्रोटेक्शन ऑफ ताजमहल protection of tiger comes around the same time but you're right the means they divided were a band-aid solution and I think a change in consciousness and something he says very important in a popular article published in the Hindu that just as in you know the Hindi film roti kapda makan food clothing shelter no one will make a film like that today there are fewer people hungry today though hunger has not been eliminated in that film the bad person is a black market trader he hoards all the grain and the hero predictably called Bharat Manoj Kumar helps to catch hold of now the sport hunter safari team operator the poacher the person who is smuggling skins of snakes crocodiles and tigers is seen as robbing the public of its heritage so I think it's a very interesting time in Indian history and the times we are living in are very different so you point to exclusion of the marginalized and the poor but the reverse is at that time The state was seen as the driver also of investment. Over the last 30 years, private sector is seen as driver of investment. At that time, the state was seen as the provider. The onset premise of roti, kapda or makan is the government ought to help you get this or get a job which helps you get this. And the onset premise of our friend Sher Khan is it's government's duty to protect the tiger for ourselves. Today, it's a very different notion across the world. It doesn't matter which political system it is. And the flip side to this, and I think here is the key turning point. In 77, the Congress lost elections. First time in India, except in certain states like Tamil Nadu, West Bengal, Kerala, people realize they can change the government. In one tiger reserve, which I am not going to name, villagers went to the chief minister and said, you have to change the state director. Because the way in which the conduct of the foresters was in many ways, which I am not going to elaborate, is not acceptable to us. So I think one is people became more conscious of their rights. Year later, 78, very tragic event, Mori Japi incident, many people are shot dead because they refused to move from Tiger Reserve, told by Anu Janai, her story, her book, Forest of Tigers, made famous by Amitabh. And through the 80s and 90s and to today, we come to a country where most people are literate. And so today, if you look at the WhatsApp groups in Indian languages, Marathi, Hindi, Malayalam, there's an astonishing amount about the questions we are discussing. So there's a greater awareness of rights. There is a retreat of the state from provision. This is very important. And a change in the idea of regulation is now supposed to be primarily to aid private sector for growth. So I would actually see that these changes, which you said, exclusionary conservation, exclusionary protection preservation. Part of it is the evolution of the system. It's becoming more mature. But it's also absorbing these greater shocks. Now there are many more players. Some of the big players have become more powerful. The regulations are easier for them to circumvent. But many of the people who are not players at all have beginning to find a voice in history. So Nirad's question, what happens when those who are voiceless find voice? Well, they're finding voice. The democracy is about people finding voice happening across the world. Naturally, it is more pronounced in a country like ours because of its vastness, size.
I'm so glad you attached all the different things that you did. Moving to how some of the large topics that are being discussed for conservation, for environment, both in India and globally. So let's say the whole COP26 thing, the 2030, 2050 kind of timelines that are being discussed, forest conservation, biodiversity, all of that. It seems to mean that the way goals are getting framed, both across the world and also in India, they're being framed in very narrow sort of mathematical ways, right?
Absolutely.
And actually Absolutely. What you need, just hearing you speak, what strikes me is that you actually need decision-making spaces and learning spaces that are large enough that can bring the yin and the yang together, right? The kind of historical narrative that you just shared, right? So are there such spaces, such decision-making spaces, which bring together the historical narrative, very sort of rich grounding in, I would say, history, arts, etc., along with science, right? To take better decisions? Or do you think, are there any sort of projects and programs that you're aware of, which have tried to create such almost containers of decision making of learning. There's this project by New York Times called 1619, which is really a huge historical archive of racism, right? So I'm wondering whether there are similar kind of projects for environmental history that could really shape the dialogue in a certain way.
So transformation of society can come about through a range of ways. But one of the ways it comes about is when many people change the way they think. So when we look at the abolition of slavery, the right to vote for women, or the concern about the human environment, we are looking at larger changes. I am very struck by the fact that in most of our conversations, we look at American instances. The United States is the world's richest country. In all fields, including garnering of knowledge, it has more resources than any other country. But what they do, most others cannot do. We don't have the resources. And everything they do need not be right. So let me give a very interesting two instances. There's a remarkable essay in Granta called Birding in Palestine. So Palestine is divided between Israel and Palestine. There are very few things Israelis and Palestinians do together. But one of the things they do together, believe it or not, is birdwatch. Now, birdwatching doesn't mean Israel-Palestine issue will be resolved. But the idea is if you can get together and watch birds, you create some spaces for cooperation. Similarly, there's a very interesting movement, Doctors Without Borders. There's another called Engineers Without Borders. And in Israel and Palestine, they have done remarkable work where they have restored some of the free-flowing streams and rivers which originate in West Bank but flow into Israel across the Green Bank. And this restoration has been a joint Israeli-Palestinian operation. It has only succeeded by addressing very thorny, difficult issues which great statesmen have yet been able to resolve with a single overriding objective, that if the river comes back to life, everybody who has anything to do with the river will benefit. In a sense, can we cooperate, not just to live in peace with each other, but to help keep the environment in the largest sense productive, livable, safe? And here, in some cases, cooperation may be difficult. I was referring to Hastio Arand, part of a forest chain in Chhattisgarh, which has a population of elephants, importance to wildlifers, very good sal, closed canopy, important to people who know forests, and full admission. I was in the Forest Advisory Committee, which had recommended against clearing it. Of course, these are recommendatory advisory committees. Eventually, government decided it can go ahead. There's very stiff resistance from the Gond scheduled tribals who have, drawing on the Forest Rights Act, distinct from Forest Conservation Act, said that Gram Sabhas have not been fully consulted. So they are raising ecological concerns as for Forest Conservation Act, the democratic consensual procedures as laid down with Forest Rights Act. There's a group of them right now on a long 300-kilometer padya. Very interesting. Something so important and relevant in Indian history, you think of Mahatma Gandhi marching from, you know, Sabarmati to Dandi, to the state capital. And they're critical of the different governments, state and union. Now, whether they're right or wrong is a matter of opinion. What I'm trying to say is that while we think of these mega ideas and solutions, it may help, and this is my submission as a student, not as a scholar of history, to go from the particular to the general. In the particular, we find the story. And through that story, we understand the general better. And I think that may be a little easier because, you know, one of the hazards of looking at any problem globally, whether it's disarmament, poverty, climate change, species extinction, the more you look at it globally, chances are at the end you may crawl under the carpet and say, it's so hopeless, I can't do anything. Now, I don't believe in the answer. So I'd like to change, you know, submit that we can change the way we pose the question. It's just a submission.
So now this brings us to the last question, Mahesh. We have had a very rich, as expected, discussion. Now, you have spoken and touched upon so many things, actually. In fact, I have 50 other questions for you, but bringing it back to forests now, you mentioned about the Wildlife Protection Act of 1972, the Forest Conservation Act of 1980, and then very important act that came in 2006, the Forest Rights Act. Right. Mm-hmm. And till then, it also draws back to the question that I posed earlier. So there is a constant evolution and the acts have also slowly moving in a certain direction. So now the pendulum is actually moving towards an equilibrium. It's not, it's far from there, but at least that movement Now it's far more reassuring that it is more realistic than it used to be in the past. I've just come back from the World Conservation Congress in France about a month ago. And a single agenda of the Congress was to talk about biodiversity loss and climate change and biodiversity loss. And with it, they are talking about, again, a milestone that they want to achieve. That is 30% of land under protection of some kind. Again, very important protection, but with the help of indigenous communities. So 30% by 2030 is what they're saying. So people, and through a lot of work, more than 1,000 papers written in different fields, they've concluded that unless we can restore or safeguard 30% of our planet, both seas and on land, we will not be able to sustain the kind of human populations that are there on the planet. So all of this can be achieved, people thought, only if the indigenous communities come in. And with indigenous community comes a very important aspect, and that is culture. And culture is passed on from generations to generations. It is science plus, you know, the interactions with their environment. So with that, I feel very hopeful that people have now realized that, you know, it's not about keeping people out. So keeping all these different things in mind, what is your wish list for forests? As in, are we going in the right direction? Is there a wish list for somebody like you who is looking at conservation from multiple lenses? People know you as a historian, but your understanding about ecology is also impeccable. You are therefore advising several very respectable NGOs who are doing path-breaking work on the ground. So what is your, you know, wish list? What does your experience tell you? Are we going to outsmart nature, or we are going to succumb to it?
I'm going to divide the answer into two parts. Okay, here goes. The idea of 30%, intellectually, the origins lie in the book Half Earth by E.O. Wilson. Wilson argued that we are encountering a very serious environmental crisis. Wilson has long argued that, like climate change, change in the carbon cycle, or change in the nitrogen cycle, or the threat of nuclear annihilation, the extinction of species is a very important challenge for humanity. His response to that challenge is to set aside as much of the planet as we can for species other than humans. Nobody who is aware of the connections between the diversity of species, the richness of ecological systems, and keeping the planet habitable, productive, and safe can question the significance of this issue. We may disagree on how many species are dying out, whether it's this or that. Those are specifics. So I'm always struck by the figure that 300,000 whales have been killed in the last 300 years, and I'm sure the number is greater. What is its impact on the nitrogen cycle? What does it do to krill populations? What does it do to the many other creatures that have a life in which the whales that have been killed and will never come back probably was embedded? However, my submission is the idea that you can set aside an area and sequester it comes from a time when biomass removal or direct removal of non-biomass material, think hunting, logging, fossil fuel extraction, was the major threat. We are living in a very different world. The world after racial caste, 1962 Silent Spring, is a world where technologies which are based on linear outcomes, I'll spray the pesticide and kill that awful pest, are unable to even comprehend the cyclical nature of nature. Her famous comment that entomology is a story in science, and that, you know, we have launched a war against insects and ended up declaring war against the earth, because the technology in its ceaseless drive, linear technology, will undermine the cyclical systems that make land, air, and sea safe, not only for birds, plants, animals, microbes, but also for humans. So I'm not sure it takes adequate account of that. So there is a very serious question about it. This is not to say that it should be dismissed out of hand. Having areas which have a minimal human footprint will have manifold advantages. Among others, we will get to know better how nature works. If the World Conservation Congress has begun to grade different kinds of human activity and culture differently, That's a great step forward. But we should be careful that we don't embrace the idea of noble savage after having decided on, you know, the anarchic, self-destructive, you know, local user. So I am hesitant about this 30% because I'm unsure whether one size will fit all. There may be certain situations, ecologies, cultures, like cohabitation, better term than coexistence is possible. There may be others where it's not. But what happens depends eventually, whether we like it or not, to a large extent on what happens within the borders of nation states. One of the ecological systems which gets a lot of coverage, and rightly so, is the Amazon. Four very important Latin American nation states, the largest of which is Brazil. And we know that in Brazil, all the records show that the political change from one political party to another has made a huge difference. One attempted to reconcile development and conservation, indigenous rights, local users, the poor, and protection. The other openly states that this doesn't make any difference. We want more GNP, we want a large economy, we want a strong Brazil. So that second part, which is articulated sometimes in very crass terms by the leadership of Brazil and was, you know, articulated in very open terms by President of the United States, who's now lost the election, Mr. Trump. That is the philosophy of many other world leaders. They don't say it, but they believe it. So to me, this second is very serious. When I say leaders, I do not only mean the political leaders. I also mean the leaders who command large amounts of the economy. We should not forget that there are some corporations whose turnover is larger than the GDP of 40, 50 states. We live in a world where there are corporations which are important in terms of information flow. So the papers are full of all of that. But what about those who are important in terms of material flows? So my submission is I welcome any such debate, 1%, 5%, 30%, 50%. But our dilemma is a deeper one, and this is where the problem is. Championing equality across species, generations, ecosystems is worthy. Just as standing for the rights of nations to be free, women, the formerly subjugated and enslaved, bonded peoples is a worthy cause. How can one differ with that? The problem isn't the principle. The problem is its articulation and accomplishment. Because as you will accept, sometimes, more often than not, two principles may be directly in conflict. It's easy if it's a right against a wrong. So we'll all agree slavery is very bad. We'll all agree nuclear war is very bad. In today's world, it's interesting, barring Mr. Bolsonaro, very few leaders will openly applaud the destruction of a forest. They won't. And the reason is very interesting. No matter which country you're in, you're very worried that 1,000 school children will write to you. Now they can do it at the click of a button. But you know, 30 years ago, they were worried because they'd get 1,000 postcards. It really worries them. I can't explain this. We can debate why. But when there is a right against a right motive, and I think this is a serious question people who work for causes should think about. And I'm very positive that the World Conservation Congress has moved from exclusionist conservation to ideas of consensus and participation in conservation. But how that will be achieved, what will happen, is different. As far as this 5, 10, 20, 30 debate is concerned, I leave it to biologists. I'm not a biologist. We can put this to those of our friends who think parks are the answer. Parks are part of the answer. But how large a part of the answer? How critical a part of the jigsaw? Can parks work if the rest doesn't? And I am very struck in the environmental movement that elements and strands in this movement, which ought to act like a rainbow, sometimes do not. So imagine there was a rainbow in which violet, white, whatever, violet, indigo, purple, red, they spent their time fighting each other instead of being part of the rainbow. And this is something I'm always stuck in environmental movement. You look at different groups of them and they spend more time. I have no problem with a healthy debate, but it would be nice if there were a healthy debate with based on light and a little less heat. So to that extent, I welcome this. I mean, this is wonderful, heartening news.
Thank you, Mahesh. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Talking About Forests. We hope the conversation sparked some ideas. To learn more about the guests and our work, do check out the show notes. And don't forget to tune in to the other episodes.